Before we dive into today's episode, I wanted to let you know that you can follow Chat Cemetery on Instagram and Twitter at Chat Cemetery. There are links to those in the show notes. You can also support the show on Patreon, where I will be releasing bonus content for this show and my other podcast, Welcome to Geekdom. You can support for as little as $1 a month to get access to all of that content. You can also rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or Podchaser. Both are extremely helpful for the show, and now let's dive into today's episode. Hey everyone, Chat Cemetery is back. Today I am joined by Crossland Shaw, and we are talking all about Later, a hard case crime novel. Cross, how are you doing today?
I am doing fantastic. I'm so excited to talk about this book. This book got me jazzed to read more King lately after I finished it a couple months ago, and wow, just wow.
Yeah, and I'm trying to get better at this as I'm covering the newer things. So spoiler warning here, we're going to just dive in and talk all about it. But for anyone who doesn't know, Cross has been on Patreon episodes prior to this one. So, you know, since this is your first main feed episode, do you just want to tell the listeners a little about yourself?
Yeah, so I've been a King fan for a long time. A lot of my friends will know me for never stop ranting and talking about The Dark Tower. I've been a huge fan almost my entire life. Some of the most impactful early fiction that I read was Insomnia, Salem's Lot, The Stand. And so I've been a big fan of Stephen King my entire life. I host a podcast that does kind of weekly reviews or weekly deep dive episodes into a fiction series at a time called Words and Whiskey. And yeah, we have a great time. So that's a little bit about me.
Yeah, and there will be a link to your show in the show notes in case anyone wants to check that out. But we are going to dive into Later, which is a book that makes it very easy to make jokes about. I'm going to send you the Zoom link later for later, as we were doing earlier today via Twitter DMs. So this one, I didn't really know what to expect going into it. I made sure I didn't read up on any reviews or anything like that before diving in, because I knew I would be getting to it a handful of months after it came out. You know, I was finally approaching the you're almost caught up point. And this one, I was stoked that it was so short. You know, it's about 248 pages, and then there's like an excerpt of Joyland at the end or something. So you don't even have to read to the end necessarily if you've already read Joyland like I have. And two, it was my second to last book before getting caught up. So I was just extra excited to sort of hit that milestone there. But Cross, for you, you know, we have a few major players in this book, but Jamie really is the focus. How do you feel about the way that King handles children characters?
I mean, that is a great, excellent question. I think that it's so fantastic that Stephen King, once again, is kind of approaching this story from a child's perspective. I think what's really unique about this story is that it's entirely baked in the first person. And that's part of the reason that I really adored it. We've got this semi-unreliable narrator in the form of Jerry, who's kind of just stringing us along in these little tiny tidbits. And Stephen King's just locked in that child voice. And man, to me, it was a dead ringer from the start. I was just in it from that first prologue page.
Yeah. This was one where I was like, oh, this is going to be a little different than The Colorado Kid and Joyland. And it's nice that each of his hard case crime novels have been very different. You know, I was kind of not sure what to expect with them because I haven't read any other hard case crime. I didn't know if they had certain criteria in order to be a hard case novel. So to get this and to have it later tie into, you know, the Stephen King universe as a whole, pretty much, surprised me. So he did something that I wasn't expecting with this novel. And I think the way he writes kids over the years has varied a little. He's really, really good at writing the sort of preteen coming of age characters. Sometimes the teenage years are a little more iffy for him, but this one is really a combination of the two. So you have that element of, okay, Jamie is definitely a kid when we first meet him. He's actually writing to us as a 20-something year old too, though. So you have that element at play where a lot of this is based on the narrator's memory.
Yeah. So part of that, that kind of speaks to the unreliable narrator thing. I think that it's so interesting that King not only chose the first person through Jamie's perspective, but he also chose to kind of intimate his own voice. This is one of the most Stephen King-y voices that I've ever read. Like his yeah, yeah, yeahs and like the smart asses and like everything else that he says over the course of this book just feels very King. It reminds me of like listening to On Writing, which I highly recommend, of course, to anyone who hasn't. It just gives you that sort of sense of his voice. In particular, one line really stood out to me, and it's from the point like 2/3 of the way through, but he says, "I don't know the word. Hang on. Maybe I do. Whipsawed. I felt whipsawed." Like the yeah, yeah, yeahs. Like all of it just, it really kind of, especially as the writer himself recounts, Jamie himself recounts that he's growing throughout the novel and he's becoming a better writer by the end of the book. It's really, really well done. And like you said, King has more of a problem typically around the teens. He does better with kind of the little kid's imagination and playing in that playground. But I think in this case, he kind of shows a character whose imagination never really left him. And so he kind of still has that sort of young at heart tone, even when he's 15. At the end of the book, or near the end of the book.
Yeah, he's a character who kind of grows up fast and much different from a lot of King's other characters. You know, he has this ability, which the book makes fun of it because they have the sixth sense joke that is still very hard for me to say. And yep. It's not exactly like that movie or that story in general. The fact that he can see dead people, but it's not one of those things where he's just this scared little boy. And he is at times, you know, don't get me wrong, but he is willing to talk to them. And here, what they do is the dead have to answer your questions truthfully. They cannot lie, but you have to make sure you phrase it as a question. You can't just have like a conversation with them and expect them to spill the beans on everything. You have to ask very direct questions. And I like that it takes Jamie a while to get a hang of that.
You know, totally. And I love that for his character, and I love the way that it builds. To me, the note about the sixth sense even seems like something that maybe came back from an editor's initial like pass on the novel, being like, oh, well, this is kind of like the sixth sense. And Stephen King just kind of balks at it. And he's like, all right, well, ghost stories have been going on for years. People have been talking to the dead forever. Calling it a ripoff is a little bit ridiculous, but I'll put it in because that's actually a pretty clever joke. And I really love the sort of laws that Jamie has to follow here throughout the story. But it just reminds me of like a note from the editor that came back, and I could just hear him again saying like sheesh as he gets this note. But yeah, you're so right on sort of the conversational aspect. And that only gets added to, of course, when we reveal that the one person who's able to fight against it seemingly isn't a ghost at all.
Yeah, and not just the fact that he can do this and it's something that is obviously terrifying to him. He's very uncertain about it. But then in, you know, reality, let's call it, his mom is a single mom and Tia is just trying her best to keep them afloat. But because of choices her brother made, the literary agency that they started is kind of up in the air. Things happened that she wish hadn't happened. They had to move from their apartment, which was, you know, next to or just a floor below Professor Martin Burkett's apartment. And he has this sort of grandfatherly relationship with Jamie, which I think King does really well. He's done this numerous times to very different degrees. You know, you have something like Apt Pupil, which is very creepy and not okay at all. But then this felt more along the lines of Mr. Harrigan's phone from If It Bleeds. So you have this sort of dynamic going on where Jamie doesn't have too many people in his life, at least in the way that this story is told. We don't really hear about friends from school, him going out and doing normal kid things. It's a lot of him and his mom against the world. And, you know, I get the feeling that it can feel that way for a lot of single moms.
I loved that aspect. I loved that they brought up kind of the 2008 financial crisis and a lot of the Ponzi schemes that folks were caught in at the time, and kind of the way that a series of unfortunate events can really kind of take you down several notches. And I thought that it was great for this kid to both understand the reality of what was happening, because he's kind of been raised from this harsh sort of second life that he's had being able to see dead people, but then also like the harsher reality of life that his single mom is going through, and how she is truly throughout this entire story an absolute badass. So kudos for writing that so well. I love the parallel that you drew, of course, between At Pupil. The one that I saw, though, was Ted Brodigan and Bobby Garfield.
Yes, that one too.
Like this reminded me almost exactly of that parallel relationship. I mean, not obviously Supernatural being flipped, but you know.
Right. He's done it numerous times. And, you know, each one has this different element to it. You know, like Mr. Harrigan's phone, he doesn't have any supernatural powers while he's alive. But, you know, not to spoil it for anyone, there's sort of this mm-hmm. twist in that one that is adding this extra element to it that's sort of supernatural. And with this, I wasn't expecting this heavily of a supernatural element, because, like I said, I had this notion that the hard case crime books were something different for King. And he showed that they were for the Colorado Kid and Joyland. But this, you know, he definitely put more of that Stephen King universe in it, especially when the ritual of Chud was brought up.
Without a doubt. I'm almost shocked that this is a hard case crime book, because while there's crime around the story, the central element of the story is not crime. It's really this sort of supernatural ability that this kid has. And especially when you bring in the multiverse connections, how does that not take over the story immediately? You know, with the deadlight, and it's just one, which is interesting. I mean, brings up a whole slew of questions.
Yeah, there's so much in here that I just really wanted him to dive into a little more, and that didn't mm-hmm. change my enjoyment of it. But the fact that he brought back all of these things that we see in It, and it just goes to show that King has so many of these different webs in his head that kind of connect everything. And I've mentioned it before on this show, but I remember someone had designed like this giant Stephen King poster, and it basically, you know, had lines drawing all of the connections to all of the different books and stories and everything. And it was so hard to look at because there were so many lines going everywhere. And this book just adds to that, because if you have been a big follower of King and you dive into this, you're getting all of that stuff from it. But if you aren't, I think he still does an okay job explaining it within this, to where it'll sort of pique someone's interest maybe, and then they'll want to dig deeper and then find out that there's, you know, this other stuff they can read that has these same concepts in them. And, you know, because this book is so short, I was like, oh, this is what he's doing with it. And I was surprised he didn't go more in depth. And I don't know if the hard case crime books have any sort of criteria or page limits, but this one was just really fun as a King fan.
Yeah, I was shocked. Similarly, I opened up this book, and I, like you, had read very little about it, so I had no idea about the sort of sixth sense. Wow, that is difficult to say.
It is.
sixth sense-y nature of the whole thing. And so I didn't have like any sort of preconception, and I just started pulling open the pages. And once I hit the ritual of Chud, like you said, my mind went, boom, this is where we are now. And all of a sudden, all of it was starting to connect. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is actually like a very interesting entry in the Deadlights history, right? And the ritual of Chud, for sure. Because we've only had, I think, three real references to the Glamours or the Deadlights. And that comes from Insomnia, that comes from It, of course, and that comes from this. And there's a hint maybe in the Seventh Dark Tower book, but is that really what it is? Who knows? But it's just, ooh, I was strangely floored by how addictive this book is. And without Without diving into the metaverse too much, I just also want to say that, like, the general idea of his natural foreshadowing throughout the story to make sure that you get to this point by saying, I'll tell you about that later, and just continuing to kind of weave in those little fish hooks in your mouth. Man, this, and maybe that's why this fits in with Hard Case, is because it is a pulpy novel that you're meant to, like, pull through compulsively.
And you obviously have the whole NYPD side of things, because Liz isn't in the story right from the beginning. She comes in a little later and she's dating Tia. So there's this new family sort of dynamic for Jamie to take in. And he takes it with stride, in my opinion. But then Liz finds out his big secret and basically uses it against him, you know, a couple of times down the road, and things don't work out between Tia and Liz. But there's this serial bomber who goes by Thumper, and even though there's so much supernatural in this, I think because of that serial bomber element and Liz being a corrupt cop and all of those other things is sort of what makes it the Hard Case crime scenario, because there's drug trafficking, there's all this weird stuff going on, and then you have a serial bomber on top of that, and it's just so much. But at the same time, even though this book is short, it doesn't feel like too much for the way the story is being told.
Which is so strange, because like you said, there is so much packed into this 250 pages that you would think that you wouldn't be able to unwind all of those threads in enough time, and yet almost all, except for like the very one at the very end, are resolved perfectly. And a thread that I didn't need an answer to, but was given like right at the very ending. Like, we'll get there when we get there for sure. But I was blown away. This book is like a lesson on execution at every level, where it's like every plot detail is unfolded just brilliantly. King is able to unpack addiction from two different characters' perspectives and how they deal with it from two different people, which is fantastic, from the relationship of Liz and Tia. You've got, obviously, the whole story of Regis Thomas inside of there, talking about authors. You've got kind of, it's strange because it reminds me, and he even kind of quotes this, but it reminds me of a Charles Dickens novel in a lot of ways. Like, it feels like there are all of these threads, and yet all of the threads are important, and all of them are tied off very nicely.
Yeah, what did you think of the sort of dynamic shift when Liz and Tia broke up? Because things were still going pretty well with Jamie and his mom throughout this entire thing, but you could tell that their relationship was getting toxic, and the way it ended did not end well by any means. And then she was just so conniving when she came back into the picture and literally was not giving Jamie any sort of say in what the two of them were about to go do. And she all of a sudden seemed to care about him and his well-being way less than she ever did before.
You know, like, Liz is an interesting and difficult character for me, because I think that she's very well constructed, where she is kind of self-obsessed, and that's where I think a lot of her and Tia's arguments came from, is because of kind of her strong-headedness. And he kind of gets into that as the sort of arguments begin to build in the first third of the book before kind of the breakup. But then the subsequent kidnappings, you're totally right. She's got a very sort of self-obsessed tone about her, where she tends to try to just propel herself and just, it's almost like, in a way, it's almost like she's living paycheck to paycheck. And so every action that she takes is fighting for the next month's rent, right? Which is a very New York thing, of course, to stuff in there too, with police officers and everything like that. And it just, it's troubling to watch, but obviously until the very end of the book, she still does have care for Jamie. She cares more than for him than, you know, a random person off the street. But it's tough. It's tough to pin down exactly that character. And having just recently finished that reread again, I'm still, Liz is such a complex character, But I mean, her end is deserving because she absolutely fell off the cliff. I mean, you can also point to the picture of, well, this is sort of the way that addicts handle things, is they lean on people to help them through a tough time until they can't lean on them anymore. And then they either fall off or get off themselves. That's kind of the harsher reality. And maybe that's what King's getting at. But I couldn't be certain without a little bit more review.
Yeah, I was just so mad at her character when she made Jamie confront Thumper, because there was one last bomb. And, you know, Jamie sees people how they die. He does not see them, you know, in a preferred state, let's say. So because he had committed suicide, you know, part of his face was missing. And the way that King described it was haunting, honestly. And you understand immediately why Jamie kept having these nightmares and seeing Thumper, and Thumper would not go away. This ghost was following him, and there was nothing Jamie could do about it. And, you know, he had made a comment in passing, I think, to Liz, and she just did not care at all that he was having these nightmares because of this thing she put him through in order to basically hold off on getting fired.
Mm-hmm.
Like, she wasn't really doing it for the greater good. That's how she guilted Jamie into doing it. But really, she just wanted to be able to keep her job a little longer because she knew the higher-ups were onto her, and if she was the one who called in this tip about this final bomb from Thumper, it would be a PR nightmare if they fired her right after that.
Yeah, it's this next thing. It's this next thing to get me through. It's just the next bit. It's just the next piece. It's such an addict's mindset, and I think that, obviously, with King's history of addiction, he totally understood that on a fundamental level. And I think that, like you said, is so important to driving the story forward and giving us this kind of antagonist. Liz's turn as a dirty cop to me makes a lot of sense. And I think that it is a great note for the story. I think that also, something that we talked a little bit about earlier, but their kind of fallout of the relationship between Liz and Tia, I think is such a well-written one, as it is so underwritten in most horror or thriller fiction to have like a relationship fall out. Typically, in most stories, you're seeing a relationship come together, and that's sort of a growth moment in a lot of ways for a character. A relationship might be a change agent. In this case, it is a change agent, but it's a change agent for Tia to grow and kind of remove herself from the sort of bad tendencies that Liz was bringing into her life. And I think that is kind of fantastic and not an often written about concept or thing.
Yeah. He also makes it so that we think Jamie and Liz are done after that, because she got what she wanted. She was able to keep her job, but more time passes and she decides to step it up one more time and just go all out, pretty much kidnaps him. She doesn't even try to guilt him into it this time. She's just like, you're coming with me and you're going to deal with it. You can tell that she's been using drugs just by the way King describes her up until that point, and then, you know, literally says that in the novel. And it's just so, so messy on her part. Everything about this, you know, sort of third act, if you will. And she is trying to find where this big kingpin, Donald Marsden, hid the drugs. She doesn't believe him when, you know, they get into the panic room by having Jamie talk to him after she shoots him and kills him in front of Jamie, mind you. She's just out to traumatize this poor boy.
No doubt. it's no drama, no nothing. It's just pure shock. It's, I can fix that, and then boom, headshot. Like, it's a line. It's just one line that completely changes Jamie's life, you know?
Yeah. Some of the time when I was reading this, I was just like, wow, King really wanted us to hate the cop, huh?
like really badly. Oh man. He even brings up even earlier some of their arguments and being like, this was even before Black Lives Matter and all of these other things, and just kind of he pulls up a lot of Drudge that the current day character would obviously know, or current day Jamie as a 23-22 year old. Mm-hmm. But he drudges that up very specifically, obviously, to call back and say like things weren't even that bad back then. They weren't that difficult, and yet she was still arguing and he's certain of her opinion on things. But I mean, at this point, Liz is so far off the rail of where she was earlier. Obviously, she's got this particularly potent cocktail of cocaine, heroin, and a dash of fentanyl, as she says, which, oh my gosh, I can't even, obviously, could not imagine, but I would imagine it would knock a horse flat, and she's taking multiple bumps of this over the course of that car ride. She is at a different level of desperation.
Which is interesting to see next to how Tia's life changed after the breakup, because mm-hmm. she basically got her mojo back, and, you know, she had a client who passed away and still had one book left in him, and Liz was present for this as well, so we're kind of jumping back a little here, but to follow Tia's trail, Jamie basically talks to this dead author who was Tia's client, recites back everything he had planned for the last book. Tia writes it. They release it after he's dead. It makes a bunch of money. They are able to get back on their feet. And you have Liz, who knows this secret and hangs it over Jamie's head too. That's, I think, how she gets him in the car the first time to go deal with the thumper situation, and it just gives Tia this chance to turn it all around finally, because we've seen her struggling pretty much since the beginning of the book. They lose the apartment and have to go move somewhere else and all of this stuff, and it was just so nice to see that even though King is going to put certain characters through hell, he's still going to give you these moments of triumph and these great moments in people's lives. But, you know, to fast forward here to the end, what Liz does to Jamie at the end is not the last thing that is done to him by the end of this book. And King just keeps the hits coming with him.
Yeah, to talk just a bit about the Tia thing, that is like the one actual moment of relief in the entire story. It's the one moment of, oh, thank God, that we get to just take a second and breathe over top of this story, because the rest is totally, it's page turner. It's like getting me through to the next chapter. I have to do the next thing. I have to see this. This isn't going well. How is Jamie going to make it this out of this? But this triumph in the middle feels like a relief and like something that she really earned because of her choices that she's made over the course of the story so far. So this feels like the one real win. Like even the end of the novel where, you know, defeats the thing, we'll get to that in a second, doesn't have that same sort of triumphant feeling. But the final moment that connects back to Tia that you're alluding to, where his uncle is also his father, is just a gut punch that I did not see coming whatsoever. And there's a little bit of foreshadowing to it in terms of kind of the overall structure. On the very first page, there's a little line, and I hated this rereading it. I was like, oh, you told me right away, and I didn't even know. Later, not much later, I found out it was more like the real stuff that comes out of a cat's ass. Sometimes the truth really sucks. And the fact that this whole time he's been talking about kind of, he's been lacing it throughout the story, but the truth that he doesn't know who his father is, and he has no idea, and it's not really a concern, and then it's brought up by Liz, and they both were stonewalled, and you get to this final moment where he's talking to the dead, and the dead can't lie, and he's talking to Uncle Harry, and he just says, I am, and he runs through the concept of, okay, well, my parents died in a car crash. They go back to the funeral. They get really drunk after the funeral, and that's when they sleep together and conceive me. And then she moves out 9 months later, blah, blah. Do you think that he was actually lying about that? Or do you think that he's lying to us about that? Because this is the moment where Jamie becomes just a little bit of an unreliable narrator. And I'm not sure if he's recounting the truth or if he's just trying to make us believe one thing or another. What do you think?
I think he's making up the story he wants to believe, because he's never going to ask his mother about it, because throughout the book, we know that he had asked his mom. She didn't answer him. Liz had asked, and she didn't answer Liz either. So both of these main characters in Tia's life asked this very important question that she refused to answer. So I felt like Jamie was trying to rationalize Uncle Harry's answer the best that he could without, you know, having to ask his mom to confirm. He just decided that was the story that he was going to believe. And really, all the other alternatives are not any better.
That is fair. That is kind of the best picture, probably. Ugh. yeah, no, you're right. I just, it's the one thing from the story which also makes me kind of scratch my head a little bit, because obviously it's this 22-year-old recounting the story. He even recounts himself growing as a writer, and part of me is just thinking about, like, at the end here, is this a moment where maybe he knows something and he just doesn't want to tell us either? You know, is he withholding the truth that he knows from us? And he's just kind of recounting this to paint his uncle father in the best light? I don't know.
Yeah, it's definitely a big twist at the end that we don't really get to see him work through, other than, you know, those few lines where he's like, okay, this is the story, you know? So I imagine that even though so much time has passed between him finding out that information and him telling us this story as the narrator, it feels like he put it in a box and did not want to fully process what it meant.
Yeah, and that also feels right for his character, because I think over the course of the entire story, he's also processing what his gift is to him too, right?
Yeah.
And so getting this information so late in the cycle kind of matches with that, where he'll probably piece it together or figure out what it means to him in his life over the course of the next decade as well. You know, the next decade might have a new story.
Exactly. And I think this is a twist in the book that people will be okay with or they will hate. I was okay with it because there was that pushback from his mom about answering that question. And now we understand why. So it does work as a very, very good reason for why she wouldn't want to tell Jamie this, especially with the state that Harry is in for the entire novel. You know, he barely remembers things. He is someone who can't really give his side of the story accurately either. You know, we believe Jamie because everything he's telling us is so unique and kind of wild, to be honest, to where it's hard to believe he could make something like that up. It's like one of those things where you're like, no, this had to have happened, because there's no way this kid mm-hmm. would have been able to make all these things up in his head and recount them as an adult, or even making them up as an adult and just, you know, being like, hey, this was my childhood. It's like, no, this has to be happening. And even though he becomes a little unreliable at the end there, I don't necessarily think it's him trying to be unreliable. I think it's him trying to not fully process the information.
Yeah. Yeah. Kind of thinking through it. Not right. Totally.
But I do want to go back to the relationship between Jamie and Martin, because we see him go off on his own to visit the professor, and they have this relationship that isn't weird. It's one of those things where Jamie eventually tells the professor what he can do, and you see the professor working through it because he's an academic. You know, he is led to believe things that are sort of tangible, and he understands that when Tia found the rings, it could have been luck, but I think in the back of his mind, he always knew something else was going on. And there's this moment between the two of them where he believes Jamie, but he's still kind of processing everything, and he's still in disbelief. And I just love that, because he is a professor, he had to take his own time to wrap his head around everything. And he amused Jamie by letting Jamie just spill all of this stuff, and he did not belittle him or, you know, be like, oh, you're just a dumb kid.
It's emphasized in that kind of moment where he says that I got to talk and he listened. And you could tell as the conversation goes on that he was processing like an academic, like you said. And I think that their relationship is actually foundational to Jamie's faith in the back half of the story that he can actually pull this off and he can be stronger than the other and kind of the process through which to go through the ritual of Chud. It doesn't hurt, of course, that the professor is obviously very intelligent and Jamie at the same time is obsessed with kind of myths and legends and has read Dracula and has that on the front of his mind and is comparing some of the mysticism and saying like, well, Stoker didn't invent all of the vampire tropes. He didn't invent any of them. He took them and he made a story out of it. And so he's like, well, then that what that means is that Thoreault, who's given me this book of fantasy fairy tales and is talking about all these fairy tales, didn't make this up. He's clearly borrowing from myth and legend in the same kind of way. And I like that kind of rationalization from Jamie's perspective as well, saying that I can trust this adult understands, even as he's piecing this through and even as he doesn't fully believe me, at the very least, he understands and can intimate and give me some option to proceed forward when he presents the ritual chat initially.
Yeah, and you also have the fact that Thumper is able to lie to Jamie in some capacity, and maybe it's because Jamie didn't ask a question and Thumper was just making a statement, but he goes through and tells Jamie that his mom is going to die of cancer, which we don't see that happen. It's kind of one of those things where we're like, it still could happen, but it doesn't. So we're just going to believe that he was lying about it. And by the end of the book, you kind of forget about that, which I think is very interesting because usually King is very deliberate with the things that he has his characters do or say. But that was one thing that I felt didn't get seen through to the end, if that makes sense.
I was very curious because we'll die from cancer within 6 months, right? So it's very specific about the timing. And that's when he's like 13, 12, something like that. And he's 15 at the very end of the story when he finally whistles him out again. So that means obviously it was a lie. It wasn't true. But it does seem, like you said, like an interesting kind of unresolved thread that could see itself rear up later in his life, of course, and also something as generic as cancer can kill a lot of people. Like that could happen at any time. So it's more of like almost a, I don't know, almost a coincidence, or like calling out something that's that kind of generic as a death is interesting. I think that Thumper's sort of lies have an interesting effect on the story because it changes the way that Jamie reacts to all of the various ghosts and the way that he even thinks about ghosts in the first place until he realizes about the deadlight and the ritual of Chud and everything else. One little tidbit here. I'm very steeped in a lot of various literature. And when I had read the line, "Oh, whistle and I'll come to you, my lad," I remembered, or I'll come to you, I think is what it says, or you'll come to me. Mm-hmm. I think it's flipped originally. The short story, of course, that it's based upon is M.R. James's "A Whistle and I'll Come to You, My Lad." And one of the critical lines that the ghost in that story carves into the wood is, "Thief, if you blow, you will weep." And it referring to a whistle. And so it reminds me of the same warning that the professor gives throughout the rest of the story, Professor Burkett gives. And you know, it is something that comes dangerously close to ending Jamie's life when he does end up whistling. But at the same time, it likely saved him from Liz. So it's a question kind of which demon do you choose? And I probably wouldn't choose the extra dimensional demon personally. But
what a brutal death for Liz, too. Just like falling down the stairs and dying the way that she did, you know. And the fact that Jamie also has to deal with that. You know, she had just killed someone in front of him. There's so much death surrounding Jamie's life that he has absolutely no control over. So, you know, he's obviously the most sympathetic character, and then followed by, you know, Tia and Martin, of course, because Martin loses his wife at the very beginning, and you have Tia just doing the whole single mom thing. But then King is so good at making hateable characters. Like, we want to like Liz, but we end up absolutely hating her. There's no reason to like a drug kingpin. And you have, you know, Thumper, obviously, who there's no reason to like either. And each of those characters, you know, maybe less so the drug kingpin, since we don't spend as much time with him, but it's very easy to hate those characters. You know, there's nothing redeemable in either of them, with Thumper and Liz in particular by the end of the story. But, you know, Jamie and his mom have each other, and the book kind of ends the way it started and comes full circle. And I do like that about this. Is there anything else, Cross, that you want to mention before we wrap up here?
So there are just two small things. One is that near the end of the book, King in particular nerds out about the Post's use of apostrophe S's, which is something that he is very specific on and follows E.B. White and Strunk's Book of Style, which is that in almost every circumstance in which you are declaring a possessive, you would use an apostrophe S, regardless of whether or not there's an S at the end of the name, meaning Biggs's, you do B-I-G-S, apostrophe S. That's like the rule. And so it's funny because it's a conflict between a number of different writers and different standards, you know, Chicago, MLA and whatnot. They all argue over it. And so he's very clearly putting his line in the sand inside of a crime novel, which is funny and bizarre. Little ridiculous tidbit. But then the other thing here is with the way that the book wraps up with kind of the larger question about the deadlight lingering out there, and if he ever whistles calling it back, do you think, especially with the way that that kind of story ends, do you think that he would ever sequelize this? Do you think that he'd ever come back to Jamie Conklin?
I feel like he could, because of the connections he made with the Deadlight and the Ritual of Chud, and it would all just depend on, you know, how he's going to do that. Is it going to be a hard case crime novel again? Is it going to be something entirely different? And because I wasn't expecting these connections to the Stephen King universe as a whole, because of the fact that it was a hard case crime book, it is something that I'm not sure about. And, you know, obviously King is getting old. He's already old, let's be honest. But, you know, it's not like we can expect a huge output from him going forward. Obviously, he's still going to be putting things out, but the majority of his releases are behind him at this point. I hate saying this, mm-hmm. but it's just, right. You know, it's just a fact of life. You know, he's in his 70s. So let's say even if he has 10, 15 more years of writing in him, and who knows what's, you know, hiding in drawers somewhere. But right. I think Jamie is an appealing enough character to where we could revisit this. Like, is his ability something that sort of tapered off as he got older? Can he still see and communicate with dead people just as well as an adult as he could as a kid? Because kids with powers is King's sort of bread and butter a lot of the times. And obviously there's other great stories, but he really loves to put kids in these sticky situations and see what happens. And I've felt like we could follow up with a lot of kids, but he also hasn't really so far, with the big exception being Danny Torrance.
Yeah, I was going to say that's the one that obviously lingers in my head. And Jamie Conklin feels like a sort of, obviously not anywhere near the same scenario, not near the breadth over the course of his career, but he does have kind of that. I can imagine a world in which we return to Jamie Conklin in a very Dr. Sleep way, in which we would see kind of the return to form. You could almost actually imagine, this is so bizarre to me that it actually goes this way, where he goes ends up going to Princeton, but you could very easily see him choosing to become a police detective and solving the crimes of the dead, right? Like, that's, you know, kind of in an Odd Thomas way, which is Dean Koontz's book, of course, but it reminded me of that in some way in my head. And so I was just curious if you thought that he'd ever come back. But yeah, I agree with you. I think that it's unlikely, but I think that the story resolves in a very satisfactory way all across the board. So not necessary, but would be a good time.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, shall we dive into ratings? This one really surprised me. I know I said that already. I feel like I'm getting super repetitive. I'm so sorry.
No, you're good. I was surprised too. I was shocked. I read this one in a day the first time. I got off the airplane. Was reading it. Got home immediately and read the last 100 pages, like just sitting on my couch, not unpacking my bags. So I totally feel you on that.
It grabbed me and kept my attention, and that is why I gave it a 5 out of 5. I don't give those often, but this one, I just loved it. This is one that I could definitely see myself wanting to reread. One, because it's short, and two, because I enjoyed it so much. You know, I believe I gave 112263 five stars as well. Will I be rereading that one anytime soon? Probably not, because it's so long.
Yeah. I definitely feel that. I think for me, this is also a 5 out of 5. This is such a good book, and I am very, very tentative to give any book that kind of a high mark. I generally rank things out of 10, but I totally think it doesn't matter in this case, because yeah, this is almost flawless execution top to bottom. I'd say the only thing that I wish is I wish I had just a little bit more, like an addict. I wish I just had a little bit more of this story, but there's nothing wrong with keeping it short, keeping it this dense. I returned the pages. I literally reread the book today before this episode for the second time and loved every second of it. So good.
Yeah, I think this one was pretty well received overall. But Cross, thank you so much for joining me to discuss this one. I am so thrilled that I am almost caught up. And I love that even now he is still writing stuff that I really, really enjoy. I know a lot of the more recent stuff has been hit or miss, not only with myself, but with other King fans. You know, Sleeping Beauties, not the book for me, but this one.
I feel that as well.
This one was the book for me, and I am so glad that I am, you know, pretty much current here. By the time everyone is listening to this, I will be current with all the King books, and this was just such a pleasant one to read.
Yeah, without a doubt. I'm looking very much forward to actually diving into Billy Summers, so that'll be a good one when that comes out on the show too, I'm sure.